Columbus Day weekend. Some people have a bank holiday, I guess, or we all have a bank holiday. But one of his books, I bought this one at the event, Lies My Teacher Told Me About Christopher Columbus, What Your History Books Got Wrong. It's a quarto, and it has a poster in it, which I have meant to spread out while I was doing the show here today. My name is Paul Muth, and now we're going into news from Neptune. Aaron Ammons is out in D.C., so I agreed to do the show for him because I had the James Kilvor interview to line up after his book chat, book launch this week at the, also at the University YMCA. His new book is called Understanding Mass Incarceration, People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. New Press Books. This is a publisher. He mentioned both the FCC ruling about local calls to prisons and jails, taking the larcenous fees out of it. And the other thing is the county board action this coming Friday, Tuesday, somewhat coincident with the Steve Salita event, passing a resolution to advocate for building programs, not more jails, roughly. You can find out more about that online. So I've been here a couple hours already. Labor hour is coming up in an hour or so. I'm going to run through singular features. Going to mention some cultural items. The jazz festival kicked off yesterday. I actually went to a house party and saw the great Andreas Kapsalis do his magic on his guitar. But Eric Binder, who's a great drummer, some great compositions I've heard him introduce. He's playing at Pizza M later. I guess the highlight is Mark Colby is in town. I don't recognize the name, but he's doing a pre-conference talk at the Institute for Creativity. That's in, here in downtown Champaign. Where, let's see, Urbana High School Big Band is going to perform there too at 4 o'clock. So Big Band in downtown Champaign, early evening. Evan Opitz, 5:30, the same locale. The Eric Binder Quartet is at Pizza M in Urbana at 9. So those are the ones that I know about. Blue Darling CD release party, Kenna May. On Facebook, she said she had come down with something, and hopefully she's better by now. She's put a band together for this show because that's the people that are some of the people that are playing on her CD, Blue Darling. So she's leaving for New Orleans in just over a month. So I don't know how many opportunities they'll be able to see her her performances. So be advised, there's two shows tonight. I think it's like 6 and 8:30 or 6 and 9 or something like that. So early and late. And that's at the Iron Post, where she won't be serving drinks. It's 3-4 minutes after the hour, and it's time to kick off the typical kind of pickle. Nothing's typical. News from Neptune Radio. Let's start out with Glenn Ford, like we typically do. Amy Goodman has a commentary about the passing of 100-year-old Grace Lee Boggs, longtime activist in Detroit. Some people in the community know her from there. Then Flashpoints had great interviews with two of my favorite guests, Gareth Porter and Robert Perry. Gareth Porter writing more about Iran, but in this case he's talking about the origins of ISIS. And then Binoy Mark, sounding very Oxfordian despite his name, talking with a Canadian producer about TPP leaks, transparency. So finally it will be revealed, and Trans-Pacific Partnership is what I'm speaking of. All right, let's kick it off with Glenn Ford and Amy Goodman, and then we'll get into some other things. I think I did a few community announcements. There's an airshifter training class coming up this week. Is that right? October 15th is the first date, and then there's a Wednesday, October 21st. So this coming Thursday, following Wednesday, if you want to take the training to possibly do an air show, let's do some subbing. One of your favorites. What else? WEFT is co-sponsoring 9th Annual Disability Resource Expo, which is next weekend at Fluid Events Center. I have time to find out more about that. Anyway, here's Glenn Ford talking. Well, I don't know if he mentions Artie Duncan stepping down, but hoping to clear the slate on turnaround neoliberal education policy. One can hope.
Arne Duncan, the outgoing U.S. Secretary of Education, will be succeeded by an even more rabid professional privatizer of public education. John B. King, a black and Puerto Rican native of Brooklyn, New York, and, like President Obama, a product of Harvard and Columbia universities, has spent his entire teaching career in the charter school business. King is a hitman for school privatization, the perfect credentials to take over from the presidential buddy Arne Duncan, the ghoul who obscenely declared that the best thing that happened to the education system in New Orleans was Hurricane Katrina. Corporations stand to make hundreds of billions of dollars from privatization of education, so it pays to tell lies about what really happened when Katrina provided the opportunity to illegally fire 7,000 New Orleans teachers, the majority of them black, replacing them with young, largely white, non-union, and ultimately temporary staff, and then converting all of the city's schools to charters. The privatizers claim that test scores are way up in New Orleans, but studies show that it's all propaganda and phony numbers. Charter schools do what they have always done. They select and retain students that tend to do well on tests and discard the rest. That's called creaming, taking the better performing students right off the top. But in New Orleans, the creaming preceded the charter school coup. One-third of the black population was driven from the city, never to return. The school children among these displaced black persons were disproportionately poor, precisely the demographic that does relatively worse on standardized tests. They never showed up for class in New Orleans' newly charterized schools, leaving a much more affluent mass of students to take the standardized tests. But the charter schools continued the creaming of students in an attempt to boost the test numbers, especially at selected schools, all the while claiming that underperforming students were not being displaced. That was a lie. For example, a study by the Education Research Alliance showed that a preparatory high school somehow lost 2/3 of its students when it converted to charter. The school claims it doesn't know where they went, but keeps bragging about how great things are for the kids that remained and for the new students, many of them non-black. Most of Louisiana's charter schools are located in New Orleans. A study by the Network for Public Education found the state's charter schools performed significantly worse than conventional public schools. The gap between Louisiana charter schools, meaning mainly New Orleans, and public schools was the biggest in the country, which had a lot to do with Louisiana overall scoring the 4th lowest in the nation. Even by Louisiana standards, New Orleans' charter school system flunks, even after controlling for factors of race, class, and qualifications for special education. And the entire nation's education system will also flunk if given over to the lying privatizers like John B. King. But don't expect the black misleadership class, masquerading as members of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, to save us. Leadership Conference CEO Wade Henderson had effusive praise for Arne Duncan and for his black and Puerto Rican protege, who will undoubtedly become an even more effective educational evil than his outgoing boss, the obscene Mr. Duncan. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Well, it shows that I didn't have a chance to preview that one. King is worse, apparently. And big money's being made on it, too. I saw a statistic about how the executives of charter schools are getting remunerated to the extent that their salary could pay for I don't know how many rank and file teachers. It's mad. All right, I didn't mention this, but Mumia has an update here, and I'm not sure if it's he's voicing it or what, but I didn't preview this one either, but this is from Prison Radio. It's a regular feature on Friday mornings, I guess, with Dog is my co-pilot, if I recall. But we'll get to that, and then Amy Goodman's memorial for Grace Lee Boggs.
Ready?
Go ahead.
Are you receiving hydrocortisone creams for your skin condition?
I'm getting hydrocortisone cream, but I was instructed by the nurse at Geisinger to use it only on my face.
Are you using Vaseline?
I am using Vaseline. I'm using Vaseline that I purchased in the commissary, even though the infirmary has equipped me with several jars.
Is it under the direction of anyone there that you're using Vaseline?
No. I am Vaselining and greasing myself. No staff member, except for once, no staff member has assisted me since they stopped wrapping.
Are you still suffering from a rash?
Yes.
What's it like? How is it manifesting?
Some parts of the body are worse than others. My whole body is itching. The Vaseline does moderate that to some extent, but understand that the Vaseline is a palliative. It is not a cure. So it is not a viable medical treatment to cure the rash. We still have not addressed the underlying reasons for the rash. I should also add, Dr. Gadea, the infectious disease specialist and consultant with the DOC's TeleMed program, said at our last meeting on 9/9/15 in the morning, I believe a Wednesday, that after looking at all the tests, it was his recommendation that hepatitis C be treated in my case. I asked him, and he repeated that several times. It's in the presence of Dr. Canem and myself.
Brett also says to tell you that the DOC filed their opposition to the plenary injunction and stated that you, Mumia, could go years without treatment for hepatitis C.
Go without what?
That you could go for years without hepatitis C treatment.
I think that's nonsense and bull because it's just ridiculous. I don't think that's a medical recommendation. That's a legal recommendation, just as the DOC is ignoring a recommendation by the person they appointed to do an infectious disease scan of my condition, Dr. Gadea.
The slow death sentence, I guess it's being called. That's Mumia Abu-Jamal with Noel Hanrahan from Prison Radio. It comes up pretty quick on a Google search, which I guess means that people around the world are interested, even if the American press isn't. Okay, I want to get a fair amount of this TPP WikiLeaks discussion on. It's a little erudite for an Oxfordian, and I guess it's not a surprise. But here's Amy Goodman's memory of Grace Lee Boggs.
Grace Lee Boggs, a century of grassroots organizing. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Grace Lee Boggs died this week at the age of 100. She left this life as she lived it, surrounded by books, politics, people, and ideas, said her friends and caretakers, Shay Howell and Alice Jennings. Grace Lee Boggs was not only a grassroots organizer, but a philosopher, a teacher, and a revolutionary. She devoted her life to empowering the poor, the working class, and communities of color, was deeply involved in a constellation of movements, from civil rights and black power to labor, environmental justice, and feminism. She lived for more than 60 years in Detroit and witnessed that city transform from the world capital of the automobile industry through social protest and unrest in the 60s to the post-industrial era, where behind the crumbling facade of empty factories, myriad experiments in urban renewal and local self-reliance are incubating.
So you don't choose the times you live in, but you do choose who you ought to be.
Grace Lee Boggs told a group of undergraduates in the film about her life called American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs. This remarkable woman lived that credo for a full century. Grace Lee Boggs was born in 1915, a child of Chinese immigrants above the family's restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island. By 16, she was at Barnard College, and by the age of 25, she had her Ph.D. in philosophy from Bryn Mawr. I asked her how she became an activist.
And in those days, the idea of a woman, or let alone a Chinese-American woman, getting a job at a university was unthinkable. I mean, department stores would come right out and say, we don't hire Orientals.
With her doctorate in hand, Grace Lee moved to Chicago, where she said,
I got a job in the philosophy library for $10 a week, but it wasn't enough to get a place to live other than a little Jewish woman took pity on me and let me stay in her basement rent-free. And the only difficulty was I had to face down a barricade of rats in order to get to the basement. That made me rat-conscious, made me join a tenants' committee against rat-infested housing, made me to contact with the black community for the first time in my life, and enabled me to become part of the March on Washington movement organized by A. Philip Randolph.
We should thank those Chicago rats for spurring her to action. The March on Washington she mentioned was not the well-known march of 1963, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, but rather the 1941 March on Washington. The renowned labor leader A. Philip Randolph, along with the gay black pacifist Bayard Rustin, both of whom would later lead the famous 1963 march, organized a similar march two decades earlier. In 1940, he saw that domestic war production was lifting hundreds of thousands of white workers out of the prolonged poverty of the Great Depression. But as most production plants were segregated, was leaving black workers behind. The movement they built forced President Franklin Roosevelt to integrate the plants involved in building the arms for World War II. This helped spur the great migration of African Americans from the Jim Crow South to the industrial cities of the North. Grace Lee married, but not the first man who proposed to her. That was Kwame Nkrumah, who met Grace in 1945 while studying in the United States. He'd returned to Africa and become the founding president of Ghana. Grace would say of his proposal, I was completely taken by surprise. I declined because I couldn't imagine myself being politically active in a country where I was totally ignorant of the history, geography, and culture, she said. Kwame Nkrumah said later, if Grace had married me, we would have changed all Africa, unquote. Instead, Grace Lee Boggs changed America. Ultimately, she would marry auto worker Jimmy Boggs, and they formed an intellectual and organizing team that became legendary in Detroit.
Jimmy came out of the Deep South. He had a sense of the agricultural epoch. Then he came and worked in the plant and had a sense of the industrial epoch. Detroit, which was once the symbol of miracles of industrialization and then became the symbol of the devastation of deindustrialization, is now the symbol of a new kind of society, of people who grow their own food, of people who try and help each other to how we begin to think not so much of getting jobs and advancing our own fortunes, but how we depend on each other. I mean, it's another world that we're creating here in Detroit.
Grace Lee Boggs founded Detroit Summer in 1992 to bring young people together to work on innovative urban renewal. The fruits of her labor continue to grow around the city with urban farms, micro-enterprises, and a focus on the local economy. Grace Lee Boggs lived a life that spanned a century, from World War I through the digital age. Young people flocked to meet her at her home, now the Boggs Center, to nurture community leadership, following in her footsteps, learning, as she said, that the only way to survive is by taking care of one another. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Quite the story. I didn't know about the Kwame. Forgot his last name. Not Kwame Ture, that's someone else. He probably knew Grace Lee Boggs, though, too. Well, it's 20 minutes after the hour. Labor hour is starting to assemble. Those are the three short features I kick off the show with. Now, been foreshadowing this Camp Mark fellow. He was a media star in Australia 4 times in a row. Not the last 2 years, but he's quite well spoken. Benoit Camp Mark, I have no idea where he's from, but he studied in Oxford in the UK and is now in the... So we'll have a bit of that today and perhaps more of it tomorrow, although there's a lot of TPP stuff from Pacifica that you won't hear anywhere else, so I'll have to be listening through that to find out what to select for tomorrow, what to present. And let's see. Let's go right to Gareth Porter. There's a lot of talk about who started ISIS, ISIL, Daesh. His latest piece in Middle East Eye, was it? I think it was wider circulated than that. Gareth Porter, known mainly about Iran, but writing about Iran, following it closely. Manufactured Crisis, the name of his book. But here he's written about the origins of ISIS, I believe, and the al-Nusra Front, which seems to be the CIA's protégés that got bombed the first day of the Russian bombing. Now, there are like 12 countries bombing the Syrian and Iraqi area. I don't think any of them should be doing it. There should be an international conference. But it seems to me that without anywhere, even Pacifica hasn't, I guess, Flashpoints perhaps covered it some, but... In Middle East Eye, there was an article about how there were Chechens and Central Asian fighters joining al-Nusra, and they were in happened to be the place where the Russians first attacked. So methinks they knew who they were hitting. These are no apology for the Chechen War, which was put up several times. The first section was done by our guy Yeltsin, so can't say about much about that, right? But... Perry, who we'll hear momentarily as well, his recent article was, should the U.S. ally with al-Qaeda? And that's not a rhetorical question. That's actually who al-Nusra is, and that's how they came about. But CIA has been good at arming jihadis. And the blowback has been bad, horrific, and probably will be worse in the future. So... Here's Dennis Bernstein this week with Gareth Porter. And then we'll get to Robert Perry and a little bit of foreshadowing, I guess, Benoit Camp Mark. He's got a segment also done with Global Research Radio out of Canada on ISIL, so Daesh. But I need to preview it as well. A lot of things said about Global Research and Michel Chodosovsky. In Montreal, but yeah, it's challenging stuff, worth one's attention, I think. Here's Dennis in Flashpoints out of the Bay Area, right?
...journalist and author Gareth Porter, who gives us an update on what's going on in the Middle East.
There has been a constant sort of expansion, escalation, change, if you will, in the war, the fighting, the players. Why don't you give us your best shot at where you see this now? It's a bit of chaos. Yesterday, the New York Times reported that actually there were U.S. weapons being fired against Russian weapons.
The larger story here about the Russian involvement, that the very great increase in Russia's involvement in the war, and the role that they're playing now, is that clearly it's an indication of the seriousness of the situation from the point of view of the Syrian government as well as Iran, its primary international backer up to now. It means that the Syrian government, you know, is very concerned about the possibility of further erosion of its very tenuous control over much of the territory of Syria. Already, the Iranians have said publicly now that 2/3 of the territory is controlled by the forces opposed to the Assad regime, that is basically al-Qaeda-based towards al-Qaeda, controlled forces, and ISIS or Daesh. And so this, I think, is part of that larger picture that the Russians have entered the war to introduce an element of force, both in terms of air power, strategic, if you will, aimed at military targets, military bases, and also, support for ground force operations by the Syrian army, which is now beginning to be another aspect of a new aspect of the war that it's going to see how that plays out in the coming weeks.
All right. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Gareth Porter. Let's turn our attention to the piece you did for Truthdig, Why the U.S. Owns the Rise of Islamic State and the Syria Disaster. And you really do sort of set it up and give us the history. And I think it really is important to go over this again in terms of the role U.S. policy failed, U.S. policy has played in the evolution of this expanding war in the region.
Well, the reason that I did this article for Truthdig is precisely that there's so much history that gets lost in the news coverage that's not a part of news coverage or even reflected at all in news coverage of the Syrian crisis and the rise of the Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria. And as a historian, as well as journalist, I guess I'm much more sensitive to the occasions of not just what happened last week or last month or even last year, but what has happened over a longer span of time, which is so significant in terms of determining what we're seeing now. As I think one wag has put it, you may be through with history, but history ain't through with you. And this is clearly relevant to the situation as far as Syria is concerned and the Islamic State. And what I do is to briefly provide an overview of just how often and how powerfully U.S. policy has impacted on the chain of events that has led to the rise of the Islamic State and to the tragedy, the terrible war that we've seen unfold over the last few years in Syria. And of course, it starts with the U.S. covert op in Afghanistan that was used to try to force the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan and used jihadist forces as an instrument for doing that with the help of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And one of the key factors, one of the key personalities as a facilitator in that whole covert op, of course, was Osama bin Laden operating out of Afghanistan to train jihadist forces there. And had it not been for that, his experience making contact with jihadists, continuing those contacts after the Afghan war, there's no doubt that al-Qaeda would not have arisen, certainly not in the form that it did, and not on the timeline that it did in the 1980s, 1990s. I mean, al-Qaeda did not really unfold until the 1990s, but Osama bin Laden was already in touch with those fighters who eventually became terrorists carrying out operations for al-Qaeda from in the late 1990s and beyond.
And this was this was expanding in Iraq. That's where it was.
Then I was just going to say, then you had, of course, the U.S. intervention, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, which created the political space for the first time for al-Qaeda to have a major political military presence in Iraq. And that was, of course, taking advantage of a situation where the Sunni population, the population of the Sunni provinces of Iraq, were up in arms, literally, against the U.S. occupation, but also against the Shia-dominated regime, which had been elected 2004-2005. So what you had then was a golden opportunity for a Sunni terrorist organization, essentially, to gain a foothold and to grow within Iraq. Of course, ultimately, they failed to gain full control over the Sunni insurgency, but they certainly did spread their influence. And even during the high point of the U.S. surge in 2007, 2008, even when al-Qaeda leaders and key officials were in the Camp Buqqa prison of the U.S. Army in Iraq, under the noses of the prison officials, the U.S. prison officials, these people were plotting among themselves the future Islamic State. They were making plans among themselves for how it would unfold. And it was those very people then who were the key people in the Islamic State in the years that followed. And of course, they gained much greater traction within Iraq in 2012, 2013, and finally then went into Syria. Actually, they went into Syria as al-Qaeda in 2011 and became a key factor in the war that was developing Syria.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Gareth Porter. His article is Why the U.S. Owns the Rise of the Islamic State and the Syria Disaster in Truth Dig. And we're sort of setting up a chain of events that leads the responsibility for this incredible situation now, bloody and terrible and getting worse situation, to failed U.S. foreign policy. The Obama administration's politics or lack thereof and knowledge of the situation and its jumping into Syria has sort of thrown gasoline on the fire.
Absolutely. I mean, what is so interesting now about the role that the Obama administration has played in this tragedy is that, the first couple of chapters of this story, if you will, were chapters involving either the U.S. Being involved in a major war in Afghanistan through its proxies in Afghanistan, that is the fighters, the jihadists who were recruited on behalf of the U.S. effort by Saudi Arabia and its friends, or, of course, the direct military intervention in Iraq. But this time what we're talking about is an administration, the Obama administration, which was clearly averse to putting ground troops into any country in the Middle East, and indeed was wary about getting involved in a major air war as well in Syria. But what it was perfectly willing to do was to have its Middle East allies, particularly Saudi Arabia and Qatar, carry out a policy a war policy in Syria that was part of a broader regime change strategy. So I think what we're looking at here is the problem of the Obama administration really being committed to regime change and perfectly willing to use its proxies, the Saudis and Qataris, to a lesser extent the Turks, as a means of carrying out that policy. And the result is once again for the United States to play a role in an extremely destructive process. In this case, essentially the disintegration of the Syrian state. We now see that there's no possibility for Syria once again to be reunited for many years into the future, if it ever happens again. And this is clearly the result of this policy of the Obama administration. Now, what I document in my article is something that is not well known. Cy Hirsch talked about this in an article a year ago about a covert operation which the Obama administration carried out beginning in October of 2011, and it was made possible by the intervention in Libya. The war to overthrow the Gaddafi regime in Libya, which then made possible a covert op to ship those weapons from Benghazi to Syria to support an armed struggle against the Assad regime. And that's exactly what the Obama administration did. And as Hirsch documented, it was a very complex covert operation through many cutouts with military men who did not even know who they were really working for, at least for sure. But in any case, it was part of a broader policy, broader operation with, in cooperation with the Qataris and the Saudis to support armed groups that they were picking and in many cases even creating out of whole cloth in Syria or even outside Syria originally. So it was an extremely reckless policy for the Obama administration. We now see the full consequences of that policy, which are really horrible to imagine.
Right, and includes the new Saudi coalition, so-called, to expand war even further. And we see the devastation spreading. We have to let you go, but we have a minute left. What are your concerns? What are you watching closely now? Where do you suppose this might go next? Is there hope with the Russians in? I don't know what the question is, really.
You know, I cannot predict whether the Russian intervention is going to have a positive impact in the sense that it will have enough impact on the military situation then to cause some of the other players, including the United States, to reevaluate their options and to at much more seriously at some way of trying to avoid a long-term continuation and worsening of this situation. But that's the only hope that we see at this moment, at least.
And where do you see U.S. foreign policy? You see any changes? You see any brainwaves coming into Washington, D.C. that might throw a bit of reality into the situation? Or should we be set, like they're saying in Iraq, the war could go on another 10, 20, 30 years? I mean, it's frightening.
Well, I don't think any war can go on that long. They do tend to burn themselves out. But as far as the Obama administration is concerned, are there signs of life in terms of intellectual ideas that are new? No, I see no sign of that whatsoever.
Yeah, that's grim. Well, I'm trying to see if indeed, as mentioned here earlier, there's an IMC 15th anniversary event going on. There was some music last night and poetry. And today there was a Skillshare. I guess it might still be going on till 11:30. Chris Rizzo, who used to do technical, is teaching people to stream radio over the internet so you can do it yourself. They're going to be documenting IMC history and actually scanning materials for the IMC archive. Real-time stuff, I guess. Future of zines in the IMC zine library. I guess somebody from the public eye should be there. Green R Space, 12 new planters from the city of Urbana, and lots of plants in front of the mural in progress by Maya Bauer. It's on the Lincoln Square side in the parking lot area. It's going to be prettier. I hope some vines will go up that cyclone Flint that surrounds the tower sometime soon. 11:30, Cope Compston, Latrell Bright, William Patterson, Hip Hop Express here on WEFT, I guess, Coco Harmon, and other people talking about what is needed now in the Community Media and Arts Center. Open house in the afternoon, Makerspace. Sasha Meinreith, I don't know if he's teleconferencing in or whether he's in from D.C. area as well. Future of IMC and Independent Media at 3 o'clock. Wine and Performance Fundraiser at 6:30, launching the next 15 years is at 10 a.m. tomorrow. And there's an article at Smile Politely about the invitation, so you can get that stuff again. And there is a link here for streaming it. And I was trying to pull that up on the computer in front of me, but here I am clicking away. Anyway, I'm getting a little distracted. We're probably only going to get a little bit of Binoy unless I start talking longer. But something about the TPP and WikiLeaks tomorrow. But the great Dennis Bernstein got a hold of Robert Perry of Consortium News, who again mentioned earlier, wrote the "Should the U.S. ally with Al-Qaeda?" He didn't put the "again" on it like I just did. But and that was alluded to in the material from Gareth Porter there. Truth Out is where it was published. I suppose it might be up on Middle East Eye, which is an interesting new online zine out of out of London that Gareth Porter writes for. Haven't heard him on any public radio interviews in a while. A while back, occasionally he'd be featured, and I don't think he's been on Democracy Now! Lately either. All right, this says it's 16 minutes, so I probably won't have any Benoit Camp Mark, but there's a lot of opposition to the TPP mounting. In Berlin, there's a big demo against the TTIP, which is the U.S.-European so-called free trade. We should stop calling these free trade agreements because they are actually corporation protection rackets. That is a little more accurately to describe them. But it's a big thing. Ford has come out against it, and Big Pharma seems like they're not happy with the length of time that they're sometimes government-funded products. That's the irony of it. They talk about how much money it takes to make these drugs, how they need to have that for ad infinitum. But they seem to be, Big Pharma seems to be unhappy with the length of time that generics will be kept out of production of health-saving drugs. Rather dramatic demo in Atlanta, Georgia, with this cancer patient fighting cancer for 6 years, talking about the TPP death penalty clause having to do with Big Pharma and the new drugs that are, some of them which are quite effective for a variety of kinds of cancers, and how they're jacking the price. All right, again, Labor Hour's coming up pretty shortly. Hang on for that. There'll be some more on Grace Lee Boggs, Gus tells me. But here's Dennis Bernstein again with Robert Perry. Again, I've been in covering the Higher Ground show. I had Professor Lowen from the Friday Forum and the Q&A. Got almost all of it on this time. And before that, James Kilgore, his new book, Understanding Mass Incarceration. I'm going to grab that and post it somewhere on, maybe on the Facebook page for the Citizens, Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice page. Build Programs, Not Jails has a page on Facebook too. No product endorsement, but it is how people communicate these days, apparently. Here's a Dennis Bernstein with his colleague in journalism, Robert Perry, Consortium News. Great website featuring a lot of Ray McGovern, too.
Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Please stay tuned. We have an extended segment on the TPP international impact, but we have to talk about Syria. We're delighted to be joined by Red Perry. He's been covering the situation there from many angles as the editor-founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He joins us from the Washington, D.C. area. Robert Perry, welcome back to Flashpoints. Before we get into your article up on Consortium today, help us unpack a little bit about what you understand is going on there, because we now clearly there's U.S. weaponry being fired at Russian weaponry and vice versa. So it is, wouldn't you say, a proxy war?
Well, I guess you could see it that way. Clearly, the United States has been supporting some of the rebel forces that have been trying to overthrow the government of Syria. And some of those forces have taken the U.S. weapons and essentially turned them over to the terror groups, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and to some degree joined up with them. That's been going on really since the fall of 2013 at least. So, and as we know, the U.S. military has spent $500 million and says that they've put 4 to 5 people in the field for that cause. Others either captured or joined the Al-Qaeda affiliate Nusra Front. So I suppose you do have American weapons in a way being used to fire at both, fire at all kinds of people, as well as the Syrian military, and now the Russian military, which has which the Syrians invited in, and they've and now joined the battle.
Well, for what it's worth, the New York Times sometimes is questionable reporting on this front, but they're saying that the rebels were firing, using weapons that they got from the CIA, and firing upon Russian artillery, and in fact hitting it. So I'm not sure what a proxy war is, but it's certainly, and in the context of, you know, what would you say now about where it is right now?
Well, the probably the tragic point here is that this could be a moment where diplomacy would be possible. The in a sense, the Syrian government feels a little more secure now that the Russians have entered the fray. That could create a situation where if the United States leaned on its clients and the Russians leaned on its client, there could be some real movement toward some form of a coalition government, power sharing, unity government of some kind, that would then be able to resist the extremists, the Al Nusra and ISIS crowd, and maybe bring some form of security back to Syria. And there could be agreements both for power sharing, but also for elections once security has been somewhat reestablished. There could be ways of approaching this, but it's now clear that President Obama has decided to stick with the Assad must go mantra. And if that's the case, if he's going to insist that Assad must go, then it's sort of hard to see how you can expect the government, the still embattled government of Syria, to simply accept that. We've seen what happens with regime changes. Obama seems to be acting as if these can be done neatly and surgically. You just eliminate a leader and everything works fine. But that hasn't been the way things have gone. When the U.S. has engaged in these regime changes, what we end up with are civil wars. It happened in Iraq. It happened in Libya. It happened in Ukraine. So these neat sounding regime changes to get one guy out and supposedly put in some people that the United States likes often end up wreaking chaos across countries. And the effort to have a Syrian regime change has certainly had the same effect.
Of course, and it gave birth to ISIS, the policy.
Well, certainly the regime change in Iraq created Al-Qaeda in Iraq when there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq prior to the U.S. invasion in 2003. And Al-Qaeda in Iraq has morphed into ISIS.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about the Obama administration is really shockingly in bed with the neocons and with that whole policy of regime change. You want to talk a little bit more about, this is, again, we're back to the policy of, you know, recreate a new Middle East that's pro-West, will control all the resources, and this is the vision, you know, regime change all the way through.
This has been the neocon vision since the 1990s. When they first began laying this out, essentially after the first Persian Gulf War in 91, the recognition of how awesomely powerful the American military could be, plus the collapse of the Soviet Union later that year, created this attitude among the neoconservatives in Washington that they could literally do whatever they wanted in terms of the world. They could have the full spectrum dominance, permanent American hegemony, et cetera, et cetera. And so that led them to sort of decide that instead of negotiating with these Arab states, Israel in particular, because some of this was formed as part of Netanyahu's 96 campaign, that instead of negotiating with these states, just get rid of them, you do regime change. And so the idea of regime change took effect, and then the Project of the New American Century in 98 urged President Clinton to engage in this sort of regime change. It didn't work then, but after 9/11, it did work in 2003. So they got their way. And even though Iraq went terribly wrong, the neocons never changed their overall view, which was regime change in Syria, regime change in Iran. And so there's been this struggle where many of these liberal interventionists, these careerist types, have joined, in effect, with the neocons with this idea that you go in and get rid of these leaders that we deem unsavory and put in someone we want. And that's still the idea. And so Obama has been a sort of what I would call the foot dragger in chief. He doesn't always agree with this, but he goes along with it to a certain degree and then tries not to do the logical, quote-unquote logical conclusion of what the neocons and the liberal interventionists want. For instance, they wanted to bomb Syria back in 2013, if you remember, and he sort of pulled away from that at the last minute. So you have this sort of strange dynamic in Washington where Obama doesn't quite agree, but he's surrounded himself by these people. And he may feel that because he pushed for the Iran nuclear deal and offended many of the same people we're talking about, that he's pushed them as far as he can. He's been trying to appease the Saudis. He's been trying to appease the Israelis. He's been trying to appease the neocons. And so he seems to be at this point, instead of seizing an opportunity, which in an odd way the decision by Russia to intervene at the request of the Syrian government has created for him, instead of doing that, he's sort of fallen back into the rhetoric of regime change, Assad must go, and that leads to a very dangerous point where the United States either clashes with Russia in some way, or it maybe allows Russia to try and fail at this, but it could lead to ultimately a victory by the Al-Qaeda forces or the Islamic State in Damascus, and that would be horrific for human rights. There would be a possibility of genocide against the Alawites, for instance, and the Christians and the Shiites. These extremist Sunni groups have shown what they intend to do. So instead of facing up to that and trying to prevent it, President Obama has chosen to sort of go along with the neocon rhetoric.
Now, it seems like the U.S. was caught off guard with this new alliance between Russia, Hezbollah, Iran, and Syria. But I guess that just shows sort of intelligent foreign policy planning by the Russians in the face of insane policy coming out of the West.
Well, I'm not sure the U.S. was caught off guard. I think the Russians have made it pretty clear what their intentions were. And there's even indications that privately Obama was not really opposed because, you know, if the Syrian government were to fall, as much as that is the stated goal of U.S. foreign policy and it's what everybody in the official Washington wants, apparently, the logic is not that some nice guys take over. It's not that these supposed moderate rebels who don't really exist are going to somehow materialize like a unicorn and go into to run Damascus. It's almost certain to be either or both of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. And if you remember, they come from the same tree. There was a branching off with Islamic State, but it was over tactical issues of whether or not they should have an Islamic State right away, a caliphate, which would be totally rejectionist toward any other faith, that they would be eliminated. And Al-Qaeda said, well, no. What we have to do first is continue terror attacks against the West. So neither of those options are particularly good from the point of view of the West and the point of view of, I think, the people of Syria. So what you end up with is if the Russians fail in this effort, which is now apparently what Obama is pushing for and what basically everyone in Washington seems to want, the logical conclusion is that you end up with an extremely dangerous and bloody situation in Damascus. And that could push whoever president at the time, whether it's still Obama or his successor, you could see the need or the tremendous pressure to go in and with a U.S. invasion force to sort of stop what likely would be a genocide. And that would mean a long-term commitment of U.S. forces in the region in a way that the American Republic, whatever's left of it, would basically be extinguished. You'd have to have a full-time military warrior state with fewer and fewer freedoms because this is something that many Americans would not want, but they would be sort of forced into. So you end up with a very ugly situation down the road. Instead of Obama seizing this moment to say, we've got the Russians on board, we've got the Iranians on board, we can pressure Assad to make concessions, we can get our guys, whatever the moderates are, these politicians mostly living in Geneva, tell them to play ball here and work something out, and then have a unified approach toward reestablishing some security in Syria. That's sort of like the most sensible approach, but it's one that's been now rejected by official Washington, the New York Times, the Washington Post, President Obama, everyone running for president, it seems like. So apparently it will not happen.
And you know, what's also interesting is to hear U.S. officials attack Russia for expanding the war, arming dangerous people, you know, I mean, all the things that the U.S. has been doing in terms of their failed policy is sort of coming out of the mouths of U.S. officials as a result of the Russian working with the Syrian government. But it's still, it's hard to see this going anywhere but to a more expanded war. At a certain point, what happens? Will Israel jump in? What do you see?
Well, Israel's already jumped in. Israel has been working with Nusra Front, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate on the Golan Heights. And I'm told that the Israelis have been, well, we know they've done some airstrikes against the Syrian military and its supporters. And I'm told that's actually more expansive than we sort of have known. That we know we've known several strikes, but apparently the Israelis have been doing a lot more on, without it being publicized. So you have here the Turks, you have the Israelis, you have the Saudis, you have the Qataris, all sort of supporting groups that we would call terrorists. I mean, unless al-Qaeda is no longer considered terrorists, they've now sort of morphed into moderates. And this whole thing about, that Russia promised to only attack the ISIS, I'm not sure where that claim even comes from. Every statement I've seen from Putin was he was going to attack the terrorists, as he described them. And that would certainly cover al-Qaeda, I would think. But we've seen this sort of bizarre attitude inside Washington where you are hearing some of the neocons actually arguing, sort of in line with Israel, that al-Qaeda should be seen as sort of the moderate force. And the more important thing is to get rid of Assad, who's allied with Iran. This goes back to this idea that there's a Shiite crescent coming from Iran through Syria to Lebanon, and that the Israelis see that as some kind of strategic threat, as do the Saudis, even though it seems to be kind of one of these old sectarian religious struggles that go back hundreds and maybe thousands of years in this case. But you have this situation where until that is sort of, as long as that's the approach, that there's going to be an effort to destroy the Shiite crescent and that take precedent over other strategic concerns like having al-Qaeda or ISIS taking control of Damascus, then I think you've got a real problem. Because unless Obama and the West make it clear to Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Qatar, and so that they must stop this. They must stop arming and supporting these radical Sunni elements. Until that happens, it's hard to see how this gets resolved.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. We've been speaking with Robert Perry. He's the founder editor of ConsortiumNews.com. Been writing a lot about Syria, what's been going on behind the scenes, trying to keep track of who's doing what to who. Bob, we appreciate the good work, and thank you for joining us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
And you all listening to
Dennis Bernstein out of Berkeley. It's a daily show, and they're up on SoundCloud if you want to hear some of that again, or hear some of their TPP coverage. I'm going to get to some of that tomorrow, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Look for coverage of the Berlin demo. There's a huge demonstration in Berlin against their TTIP, which is the U.S.-European, don't call it trade agreement, because it's a corporate protection racket, as I said earlier. Well, you might have to wait until now on Monday to actually hear any coverage of it because the corporate press doesn't want to. 359. No. I just lapsed into a pledge support pitch there without even thinking about it. WEFT Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio. It's time for the labor hour, and it's time for me to get caffeinated. Thanks again for listening. Enjoy your day. A lot going on. Check some of it out. Live local music around town as well. And thanks to James Kilgore for giving me some of his time at the 8 o'clock hour while I've been filling in for Aaron Higher Ground. And hopefully he'll report back in a while about the march in D.C. A lot of complexities there indeed. WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio where opinions you hear are those of the speakers.